year, at least one in four Americans is diagnosed with a heart condition. At that point, there are some very important decisions to make for your future. The harsh reality may be you are left with more questions than answers. This is where the Heart Rhythm Center podcast can help. We are your what, why, and how of palpitations, heart rhythm disorders, pacemakers, and defibrillators. Welcome your host, Dr. Jeffrey L. Williams, board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular disease, and clinical cardiac electrophysiology. The information included in this podcast is for educational purposes only. It is not intended or implied to be professional medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice. Listeners should always consult their healthcare providers to determine the appropriateness of the information for their own situation, or if they have any questions regarding medical conditions or treatment plans.
Hi, this is Dr. Williams, and welcome to What Are Palpitations? Podcast 6, What is Atrial Fibrillation? Atrial fibrillation is the most common clinical arrhythmia encountered in cardiac electrophysiology, and it is a problem of the top chambers in your heart, that is the atria. Approximately 5% of people over 60 years of age have atrial fibrillation. If you have atrial fibrillation, your most significant risk is for stroke. And the first step in treatment is deciding what type of anticoagulation is appropriate for your situation. Aspirin alone may be adequate, but you may require warfarin or one of the newer oral anticoagulants that can be used in place of warfarin. Warfarin is also called Coumadin. There are triggers for atrial fibrillation that are primarily located in the pulmonary veins connected to your left atrium. These electrical triggers are called pulmonary vein potentials. There are many complex mechanisms that underlie how the electrical properties of pulmonary veins may cause atrial fibrillation. We are still learning about the science of how the pulmonary veins are linked to atrial fibrillation. The advancement of this science may result in the development of better treatments and perhaps a cure for atrial fibrillation. The next issue is to determine how to manage the heart rhythm abnormality itself. A rhythm control strategy is in place when you are given antiarrhythmics, or medications that help maintain a normal rhythm, to prevent atrial fibrillation from happening. This strategy is ideal for patients with severe symptoms. Antiarrhythmics include flecainide, propafenone, amiodarone, sotalol, dofetilide, and dronedarone. A rate control strategy allows the presence of atrial fibrillation, but prevents fast heart rates with medications to slow your heart rate. This is a good option for patients who do not feel their atrial fibrillation. Believe it or not, 3 out of 10 patients with atrial fibrillation may not have any symptoms. Medications to help slow your heart rate while you are in atrial fibrillation include beta blockers such as metoprolol, atenolol, and carvedilol, calcium channel blockers such as diltiazem and verapamil, and digoxin. The most important thing to realize is that atrial fibrillation will not be completely treated or understood in a single visit. Be patient with your care provider. A medicine that works for one patient may not work for another. Next, we're going to discuss the normal electrical activation versus atrial fibrillation. The normal electrical activation of the heart was described in Podcast 1. The P wave corresponds to the electrical activation of the right and left atria. The P wave then triggers the bottom chambers, or the ventricles, to beat and pump blood to the rest of the body. Each P wave corresponds to one heartbeat during normal electrical activation. During atrial fibrillation, the atria beat very fast and irregularly. This is called fibrillation. Thus, instead of one P wave triggering the bottom chambers approximately once per second, the bottom chambers receive 5 or 6 signals per second. This atrial fibrillation can then cause your bottom chambers to beat at approximately 1 to 200 beats per minute. An electrocardiogram depicting atrial fibrillation is available to view at my website, heart-rhythm-center.com, and look for Podcast 5. What are the signs and symptoms of atrial fibrillation? When your heart beats irregularly and faster than 100 beats per minute, you could have symptoms such as chest pain, shortness of breath, palpitations, dizziness, and fatigue. It must be noted that atrial fibrillation can cause symptoms even if your heart rate is less than 100 beats per minute. Atrial fibrillation usually causes an irregular heartbeat. However, 1/3 of patients may not have any symptoms. What are the causes of atrial fibrillation? When I encounter a patient with atrial fibrillation, I look for a host of other possible causes of atrial fibrillation, in addition to evaluating a patient for increased stress, decreased sleep, and use of caffeine, alcohol, and nicotine. A common mnemonic to help remember all the causes of atrial fibrillation is THIMPAD, THIMPAD. The T stands for thyroid. An overactive thyroid can trigger atrial fibrillation, and your doctor will generally screen for thyroid issues by checking your levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH. H stands for hypertension. High blood pressure can put a strain on your heart, specifically the atria, and lead to atrial fibrillation. Oftentimes, patients are admitted to the hospital for atrial fibrillation with rapid heart rates, and simply controlling the blood pressure can terminate the atrial fibrillation. I stands for ischemia or infection. Ischemia refers to active coronary artery disease, also called blockages in your coronary arteries, that may rarely lead to atrial fibrillation. Also, any infection could increase your body's inflammatory state and trigger atrial fibrillation. M stands for myocarditis, which is an inflammation of your heart muscle during or after a viral illness that could lead to atrial fibrillation. P stands for pulmonary issues. Any strain on your lungs, such as pneumonia, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or obstructive sleep apnea, could lead to atrial fibrillation. Alcohol is a direct toxin to your heart and can lead to atrial fibrillation and even heart failure. And finally, D stands for drugs. The use of illicit drugs such as marijuana, cocaine, or methamphetamines can lead to atrial fibrillation. Congestive heart failure can be a cause of atrial fibrillation. Conversely, atrial fibrillation can cause heart failure. As discussed earlier, patients with heart failure have increased strain placed on the heart, and this can lead to atrial fibrillation. Less commonly, atrial fibrillation can lead to sustained periods of fast heart rates that can cause heart failure. Obesity is such an important risk factor for atrial fibrillation that I have to talk about it separately from other issues. Obesity is defined as a body mass index, or BMI, greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared. BMI is a tool that takes height into account to standardize weight assessment. Morbid obesity is defined as a BMI greater than 40 kilograms per meter squared. Obesity has a multitude of ill effects on the body. Increased blood pressure, increased inflammatory milieu of the body, increased levels of bad cholesterol, and increased risk of diabetes. These can then increase a person's risk of coronary and peripheral vascular disease, obstructive sleep apnea, and hypertensive heart disease. Obstructive sleep apnea is a particularly potent trigger for atrial fibrillation. Obstructive sleep apnea decreases the amount of oxygen in the blood, increases inflammation, and increases pressures inside your heart. These can all, in turn, increase the risk for atrial fibrillation. Weight loss has been shown to decrease the frequency of atrial fibrillation episodes, which is called secondary prevention, and prevent the first occurrence of atrial fibrillation. This is called primary prevention. There is an assessment we can use to see if you're at risk for obstructive sleep apnea. It is called the STOP-BANG assessment. Questions include, do you snore loudly? Do you often feel tired, sleepy, or fatigued during the daytime? Has anyone observed you stopped breathing during sleep? Do you have or are you being treated for high blood pressure? Do you have a BMI more than 35? Is your age greater than 50 years? Do you have a neck circumference greater than 16 inches? And is your gender male? Based upon your answers to these questions, your healthcare provider can assess your risk for obstructive sleep apnea. You can see from the exhaustive list of possible causes why I consider atrial fibrillation a symptom of other disease. I try to find reversible causes of atrial fibrillation prior to considering medications such as antiarrhythmics. Some patients are described as having lone atrial fibrillation. Lone atrial fibrillation means that we can't find any obvious trigger or cause for atrial fibrillation, and it may be more common in younger patients with atrial fibrillation. People often ask me, what causes atrial fibrillation? You can see how this can be a difficult question to answer in a single office visit. I often tell patients that the person who can answer that question or come up with the cure will get a Nobel Prize. There are many diseases a doctor needs to check for when you have atrial fibrillation, but the doctor may not find a clear cause for your atrial fibrillation. We do understand that there are triggers for atrial fibrillation that are primarily located in the pulmonary veins connected to the left atrium. Ablation can be used to prevent these triggers from starting atrial fibrillation. The goal of electrically isolating or preventing the electrical communication between your left atrium and your pulmonary veins by performing an ablation is to help decrease the burden of atrial fibrillation. The electrical triggers for atrial fibrillation can be located in many other places in your right and left atrium, which may help explain why there is no cure for atrial fibrillation by ablation at this time. One of the most important things to understand is your risk of stroke. Your risk of stroke varies depending on the risk factors you may have. Risk stratification systems have been developed to help care providers determine which patients are at the highest risk of stroke and may need more than just aspirin as an anticoagulant or blood thinner. An example of a risk scoring system is called the CHADS-VASc score. C stands for congestive heart failure. H stands for hypertension. A stands for age greater than 75 years. D stands for diabetes. S stands for stroke or TIA. V stands for vascular disease. A stands for age of 65 to 74 years. And S stands for female sex. Examples of vascular disease include prior MI or myocardial infarction, peripheral artery disease, or aortic plaque. Each of these elements is worth 1 point, except age greater than 75 and stroke are worth 2 points each. Generally, a CHADS-VASc score of 1 or more implies that aspirin alone may not be adequate. If your risk factors merit more than aspirin alone, your doctor will likely discuss several options for anticoagulation. Warfarin, also called Coumadin, is a once-daily pill that requires regular blood laboratory tests to monitor the lab value called the International Normalized Ratio, or INR for short. The INR is used to help determine how much warfarin you should take on a daily basis. A normal INR value is 1, and we generally try to keep patients at an INR value between 2 and 3. Every patient is different, and patients may require very different daily doses of warfarin. Furthermore, warfarin may interact with a host of different medications, and any change in medication may necessitate a change in warfarin dosing. Antibiotics and medications such as amiodarone can cause dramatic changes in INR values. There are newer agents called target-specific oral anticoagulants, and these are a new class of medications that are taken once or twice daily and do not require routine blood laboratory tests. These medications include dabigatran, known as Pradaxa, apixaban, known as Eliquis, and rivaroxaban, known as Xarelto. More of these types of medications are becoming available each year. Each of these medications requires your doctor to discuss the pros and cons of stroke prevention weighed against the risk of bleeding. Any medication, including aspirin, that thins your blood to prevent blood clotting can increase your risk of bleeding. It is important to discuss your risk of stroke and anticoagulation options with your care provider. Is there a difference between atrial fibrillation and ventricular fibrillation? Atrial fibrillation and ventricular fibrillation are very different. Ventricular tachycardia refers to a very fast beating of the bottom chambers of your heart, the ventricles, and can cause low blood pressure, loss of consciousness, and even death if not treated. Ventricular fibrillation refers to an even faster beating of the bottom chambers of the heart, the ventricles, and is often fatal. During sudden cardiac death, when the heart goes into ventricular fibrillation, the bottom chambers just quiver and no blood is pumped. This leads to a loss of blood pressure, followed by loss of consciousness, which is called syncope or fainting, and then, if not stopped quickly, death. It may seem confusing, but it is possible to survive sudden cardiac death. A person can faint because of sudden cardiac death, such as ventricular fibrillation, and be revived quickly depending upon the underlying medical condition and availability of emergency personnel. Is there a cure for atrial fibrillation? Unfortunately, there is no cure for atrial fibrillation. We can use medicines and even ablation to help decrease your symptom burden from atrial fibrillation. Some patients can go several years without atrial fibrillation symptoms from medicines and/or ablation, but there is no cure for the condition. The appropriate course of action is to try antiarrhythmic medications before considering an invasive treatment such as ablation. Ablations for atrial fibrillation, as opposed to other types of supraventricular tachycardias, including atrial flutter, can entail significant risk. If a particular antiarrhythmic does not work for a patient, I usually try a different one. Not all patients respond to medications the same, and an antiarrhythmic that worked for one patient may not work for another patient. If the atrial fibrillation is not causing symptoms such as chest pain, shortness of breath, or palpitations, then the most important strategy is decreasing the risk of stroke with anticoagulation and ensuring that heart rates are adequately controlled. Atrial fibrillation in the setting of heart failure should be discussed with your care provider. Common clinical scenario number 3. A 74-year-old woman with no significant past medical history was found to have atrial fibrillation causing severe symptoms of palpitations and shortness of breath, as confirmed with a 24-hour Holter monitor. She had a CHADS-VASc score of 2 and was tolerating treatment with dabigatran without obvious bleeding. She initially presented with symptomatic paroxysmal atrial fibrillation and was placed on anticoagulation as well as metoprolol and flecainide. Several months later, she was readmitted to the hospital with highly symptomatic atrial fibrillation lasting 8 to 24 hours, breaking through the flecainide. Her flecainide was changed to dofetilide, and she required a cardioversion to return to her normal sinus rhythm. At that time, we talked about considering ablation versus continued attempts with antiarrhythmic medications. She opted for continued attempts at medical management. She had further episodes of atrial fibrillation and required a change from dofetilide to sotalol, only to present several weeks later with highly symptomatic atrial fibrillation lasting 8 to 24 hours. After trying multiple antiarrhythmics, the patient ultimately decided to proceed with an atrial fibrillation ablation, which was performed without any major complications. After the procedure, she still experienced periods of atrial fibrillation, but they were less frequent and occurred with less severe symptoms, and she was happy with this level of improvement because the symptoms no longer significantly disrupted her life. What is atrial flutter? Atrial flutter is like a first cousin to atrial fibrillation. First and foremost, we treat the risk of stroke from atrial flutter the same way as in atrial fibrillation. In fact, up to 60 to 70% of patients with atrial flutter have likely had atrial fibrillation within the past year. Typical atrial flutter is located in the right atrium and can be easily cured with an over 95% success rate using catheter ablation. Whereas non-typical, or atrial flutter located in the left atrium, is not as easily cured. Sometimes your doctor cannot tell which type of atrial flutter you have until measurements of the inside of your heart are made during an electrophysiology study. Many patients can be considered candidates for an ablation of atrial flutter during the first episode. It is important to talk to your doctor about the risks, benefits, and alternatives to considering ablation for atrial flutter. Of note, the ablation for typical atrial flutter is generally considered less risky than an ablation for atrial fibrillation. Moreover, atrial flutter can be cured, whereas atrial fibrillation is generally considered not curable, although ablation can significantly reduce the symptoms caused by atrial fibrillation. The next common clinical scenario, number 4, is another example of atrial fibrillation. A 63-year-old man with a past medical history of obesity, hypertension, untreated obstructive sleep apnea, and tobacco use was referred for evaluation of his atrial fibrillation. The patient was doing well on metoprolol and flecainide. He reported 1 to 2 hours of mildly symptomatic atrial fibrillation that occurred every 1 to 2 weeks, mainly at bedtime. These symptoms did not disrupt his activities of daily living, and he was comfortable with his symptom burden. We talked about his level of symptoms from atrial fibrillation, as well as non-invasive means by which we could further reduce his symptoms, such as treatment for his obstructive sleep apnea, regular exercise, weight loss, tobacco cessation, and more aggressive blood pressure control. At the end of our visit, the patient decided to continue his current medical regimen and attempt the non-invasive measures described. Several months later, the patient appeared in my office with a cough severe enough that he could not complete full sentences. Since our last visit, he had been evaluated by another electrophysiologist who recommended an ablation for his atrial fibrillation. The patient underwent a cryoablation and suffered damage to his respiratory system from the procedure. The patient reported feeling worse than he did before the ablation, with no change in the frequency of his atrial fibrillation. This is a powerful example of the importance of listening to the patient to assess severity of symptoms and counseling patients on the risks, benefits, and alternatives of procedures. In summary, atrial fibrillation is a very common arrhythmia encountered in cardiology, and its prevalence is increasing as the population ages. We are still trying to understand the electrical causes of atrial fibrillation, but it is clear that many patients with atrial fibrillation can have their symptoms reduced with both lifestyle interventions as well as medications and possible ablation. The most significant risk of atrial fibrillation is stroke, and the first step in treatment is deciding what type of anticoagulation is appropriate for your situation. Aspirin alone may be adequate, but you may require warfarin or one of the newer oral anticoagulants. You must realize that atrial fibrillation will not be completely treated or understood in a single visit. It is important to be an active participant in managing your atrial fibrillation with your care provider. Thanks for listening and learning about atrial fibrillation, and hope you'll join me for Podcast 7, What Are the Common Ventricular or Bottom Chamber Tachycardias?
Thank you for listening to the Heart Rhythm Center. If you have enjoyed this episode and would like to access extensive explanations of topics discussed today, together with helpful illustrations, head over to www.heart-rhythm-center.com, where a full list of available publications on Amazon can be easily accessed. That's www.heart-rhythm-center.com. And please subscribe to the Heart Rhythm Center blog, as well as Dr. Williams' author page on Amazon, where his books discussing arrhythmias, pacemakers, and defibrillators are available in print and electronic Kindle versions.